You got a lot you could be doing, and I know you're tired, and I got the worst slot right after lunch. Cope gave me this lousy slot. And up against Jonathan Stormont, who is one of the best speakers that I know of as a young guy, so you can leave now, I won't be offended. And if everybody leaves, I'll go with you to hear Jonathan speak. He's such a gifted and good guy, so I'm not sure who else I'm competing against here, so I'm thrilled to have just a few of you. And I start off by telling you a little bit about who I am. And my name is Mark Moore, and I run a company called Manna. We make this stuff. It's RUTF. It's peanut butter for malnourished kids. It's kind of an odd thing. Has anyone ever heard of it? Besides, you raise your hand because I know the. So Ben has. I don't want to out the Harmon family here too much, but their son and I work on this project, and we started 4 years ago now, I guess. I was living in D.C. I lived in Uganda for 10 years, kind of wandering around in the villages and sitting down with people. And generally the question in Uganda is about one of these issues right here. When you walk into a rural community in the middle of nowhere in Africa, it's not that different than walking into a rural community in Kensett, Arkansas, where I know Nita has spent some time in her life. And you begin to say, what's right about this place? And that's a pretty short list when you're in Kensett, Arkansas, or when you're in Kamuli, Uganda, generally, sadly. But also in Flint, Michigan, my hometown. I come from one of the roughest towns there is. We've gone from about 350,000 people when I was in high school to under 100,000. There are big deserts. When you drive into my old hometown, there are just rows and rows of houses that you can buy for a dollar. It's pretty shocking. So we win each year, kind of the murder capital of the United States in Flint. And so I had an advantage when I was in Africa to relate, I think, in a way to Africans, because I'd sit down and say with people, what's wrong with this village? And it's funny, I don't know if many of you have seen the movie Beaches. Remember Beaches a long time ago, Bette Midler? And this is a great line for that movie where she says, oh, you know, we've talked so much about me. Let's talk about you. What do you think about me? And it struck me that that was much of our agenda in Africa, that we had this mission and this goal. And it also struck me how arrogant it is, whether it's your church in your hometown or a missionary going across the world, to say, I've got dreams for you. And they're like, I don't even know you. Do we go to the homeless people and we pass out peanut butter and jelly sandwiches and say, I have dreams? In a way, that could be encouraging, but I think more so it would be a lot more interesting and a lot more effective to say, what are your dreams? And if they don't have dreams, then that's a problem. And you've got to say, well, you know, we got to get about the business of actually having some dreams. I have only a few discernible skills. One of them is that I speak Lusoga, which is a language in eastern Uganda, which is of no use here in the United States. The other skill I have is growing up, I had a friend named Terry Kuhn, and we always talked backwards. And by balking, we would balk backwards, so I'm talking backwards. We would whip around the flirts, if that makes sense to you, whipping around the flirts. Have you ever seen this? In fact, Archie Campbell used to do it on Hee Haw. Have you ever seen Hee Haw years ago? I don't know if I absorbed that as a kid, but I got this talent for balking backwards and whipping around the flirts. In fact, me and Terry Kuhn, his name was Terry Kuhn, I called him, he was Kerry Toon. My name, obviously, backwards is the same, Mark Moore. We talked backwards most such in Skyhool in high school that we started to balk backwards and then whip around the flirts and whip around the flirts again to where we were talking normal accidentally. That's how bad it got. So we had this language that we would talk to one another. And so I thought I'd tell you a development story that you know by whipping around the flirts. I've never done this in front of a crowd, so I don't know how well it'll go. But it's the story of the Peeth Little Thrigs. You know the story of the Peeth Little Thrigs? You might have to. I'll talk slowly first, and then. So, Tunsipanawai, Gong Gong Alo, there were pea fiddle legs. Actually, there were pie fiddle legs. There was a pama mig and a papa fig, and they had sea thruns. Got it so far? So, first fiddle leg was walking down the road, and he saw a guy wiving a dragon, and he said, hey, Hella, I'd like to buy some of that straw and hild me a bow. Someone will build me a strauss a haw. So he strawed the baw and he hilt him a bow, strauss a haw. And along came the big wad wolf, and the big wad wolf said, piddleig, piddleig, et me lin. He said, not by the chair of my henny hen hen. He said, I'll puff and I'll huff and I'll hoe your blouse down. So he puffed and he huffed and he huffed and he puffed and he hoed down his blouse. And he ate that piddleig. Now, the second Pitalig was walking down the Ramesode. He saw a guy wiving a dragon. He said, "Hey, Hela, got you what?" And he said, "I got a strode of law. I mean, a strode of a load of stricks, a load of sticks, stode of licks." He said, "I got a stode of licks." And so he said, "Stop those bicks," and he hilt him a bouse. He said, "I'm going to hilt me a bouse, and it's going to be a stouse of hicks." So he built this house, a stouse of hicks, and along came the big wad bolt. Big Red Wolf comes in and says, "Piddle-dig, piddle-dig, et me, Lynn." And he said, "Not by the chair of my henny hen hints." He said, "I'll puff and I'll huff and I'll hoe your blouse down." So he puffed and he huffed and he hooed down his blouse and he ate that piddle-dig. And the third piddle-dig was a little sharper than the other piddle-digs. He was walking down that same road and he saw a guy driving a wagon or wiving a dragon. And he said, "Fay, hell, I got you what?" And he said, "I got a brood of licks." So he said, "I want to sty those bricks." So he bought those bricks and he hilt him a blouse, and it was a brouse of hicks. So he built this brouse of hicks, and along came the big wad wolf, and the big wad wolf said, "Piddle-dig, piddle-dig, let me in." He said, "Not by the chair, hair of my cherry chin, chin, you got to change it up sometimes." And he said, "Then I'll puff and I'll huff and I'll puff and I'll huff and I'll hoe your blouse down." And he puffed and he huffed and he huffed and he puffed and couldn't hold down his blouse. And so he said, "I'll climb up on the roof and I'll chide down the slimney." So he got up on the roof and he was going to chide down the slimney, and the piddle-dig who was inside saw that wig wad wolf was going to chide down his slimney, so he ran in the kitchen and he got him a narp shife and he got him a pot of wat hotter and he put it in the fireplace, and that big wad wolf came, chid down the slimney, and when he chid down the slimney, he said, "Ow, that is hot on the mutimus glaxus of a big wad wolf." And he got that narp shife from the kitchen and he cut open the big wad wolf, and he and his beethruthers, they jant the dig, and all was okay. And the story of the Pethro Liggs. Now, my dad, I used to always, we had this big thing of talking backwards, and I thought, I wonder if I can tell that Stolhory in Walking Tackwards, because the story of the three little pigs is the story of development. And the fact that people have decided that living in sticks and straw is okay is a shame, isn't it? It's a shame in the culture we now live in. 1 week ago today, I was in Malawi, and I was sitting in a house of straw, a house of sticks. I was sitting with a mom. Her son was a miracle. No, these names have not been changed. This is really the name. I was with World Vision. David Todd Harmon and I worked together at Mana, and I got a chance to go over with World Vision. And we walked into this mother's house, and she had a little baby that was on the brink of death. And this child had been fed this stuff. It's just peanut butter. It's not rocket science. It's just simple. And this baby was thriving and smiling and happy, and it was amazing. And I was so proud because, as David Todd can tell you, we look at a lot of spreadsheets and we answer a lot of phone calls and we run this factory that makes peanut butter. And it's so encouraging to see that this life had been transformed and saved. Now, I don't tell you that to brag about Mana. Peanut butter, this wasn't our idea originally. Other people make it, but we're a new company that makes it. But our vision for this and our dream for this is that it would be part of God's kingdom come. And that's one of the things I want to challenge you with today and talk to you a little bit about the Millennium Development Goals, which is a pretty simple thing. And I want you to be encouraged by that and to go out of here, hopefully with each person maybe taking something different, because I think the way these applies to your community in Searcy, Arkansas, or back in Charlotte, or in Amarillo, Texas, or wherever you're going, hopefully could have some implications for the way your church sort of does ministry. So these are the Millennium Development Goals. Now, how many people have heard of them before? So they're not wildly popular. They don't do a very good job marketing these things. It's 8 things that at the turn of the millennium, they decided, and the "they" here is the G8. You know the G8 is. G8 is the richest 8 countries in the world. We're one of them. Japan and Great Britain and Germany and a couple others. And they got together and they said, "Listen, for the last 50 years, development has been a colossal failure." And I think that's one of the points that we need to take some encouragement from in the church, is that people criticize the church and say, "You guys are out being missionaries." And I was a missionary for many years, and they criticize us. But also development, the secular effort of development, has been a big failure. A lot of money has been poured into a lot of places in the world, and we're not doing a whole lot better. In fact, when they started measuring these in 1995, they realized in some places, in fact, in many countries, we were on this nosedive where things are actually getting worse. It had been 30 years since we sent someone to the moon, and people were living in houses of sticks and straw, and the big bad wolf of malaria and of AIDS and of TB is just gobbling up kids, all on our watch. And so, credit to the G8. The G8 said, "You know what, are we going to go into a new millennium just dumping more money into the same old ideas, or are we going to have a marked change?" And so, with the Millennium Development Goals, they got together and said, listen, when the new millennium starts, let's have a 15-year goal and let's measure things and let's all get together. And so and they actually expanded to the G20, so the 20 richest nations in the world, all of whom are giving out money. So when I think of this, and you think of your town, I think of our town in Charlotte. There's a church on every corner. I mean, there are so many churches in Charlotte. Think of how hard it would be to coordinate those churches. They all have their different agendas back in Dallas and even in small towns. To get a bunch of church people together, get them to do anything, how hard is that? Different denominations. If you showed up and said, hey, I've got a great idea and we're going to kind of lead this, how many people would listen? I get discouraged thinking about it, right? Now imagine you're the G20. 20 different countries with different political agendas, with different philosophies, with lots of money. And this week, the United States is changing its food aid policy. You know what? Food aid, we are the most generous country in the world, and we give away a lot of food. We give away a lot of wheat and a lot of rice and a lot of corn and a lot of soy. And so hungry people around the world are really lucky that our farmers are as good as they are because they're amazing. We have computer-operated, tractors that drive around. We have farms in Iowa and Nebraska that if you combine them are bigger than France. These are big farms. There are farms in Ukraine that are bigger than big chunks of Europe. There are farms in the southern part of Canada. Just this huge capacity to grow enough food for the world. And so the U.S. is very generous and we give it away, but so is Norway and so are these other countries, not to the point that we are because we have a bigger GDP, so a little slice of our pie is a lot. So imagine if you come to the United States and say, hey, fall in line with the Millennium Development Goals. And to the credit of Bill Clinton and then after that, George Bush, they said, you know, it's going to be hard because how functional is Washington, right? Not very. And we think it's not now. It never has been very functional. But they agreed and they said, we are going to hold them accountable. In fact, the United States said, we can't agree. When you sign up with a treaty in the United States, we're not like other countries. Many countries can say, yeah, we like that treaty. We can't do that by law. We have to say there has to be a mechanism for us to actually measure and do this. We can't say we're going to do it. We have to do it if we're going to sign up. So we created a thing called the Millennium Challenge Corporation. You ever heard of Jeff Sachs in Millennium Villages? So he's a smart guy in Boston. He works at Tufts University and at Harvard. And really, a bunch of really good people started getting together and saying, this is exciting because we are going to make some progress. So they picked these eight areas. And it strikes me that these eight areas are all things that face people in Amarillo. I hadn't heard of the Millennium Development Goals, but I was wandering around in the villages of Uganda. But I would walk into a village, and at first I would show up, and I would do a version of Bette Midler. You know, let's talk about you. What do you think about me? I'm here. I have a college degree. I'm learning your language. We're just so great. And I never really said that, but as I look back, I'm kind of embarrassed. I think, wow, I showed up in these impoverished areas and was just clueless. And so after a while of learning language, we had a transformational moment in our team, and after about 3 years, I started showing up in villages, and I had a Land Cruiser. I'd get out of my Land Cruiser. First off, imagine if you're living in the middle of a village in northern Uganda or in eastern Uganda, and some guy drives in the nicest car you've ever seen and says, voila, it's like stepping out of a spaceship and speaking their language, and people are excited about that. And I began to ask, what is right about this village? And people would say, it would be a very short list. You can imagine some of the small towns you're in. But then if I said, now tell me what's wrong with this village, and I had my Sharpie and or a little chalkboard, and they would always say, here's the thing. Number one is we're poor. I'd say, tell me about that. And they'd say, we don't have any money. Well, tell me more about that. Well, I mean, why is that your biggest problem? Well, because if we had money, we would go to the doctor. If we had money, we would start businesses. If we had money. And so we talk a lot about economics at a very basic level. And probably talk for 30, 40 minutes and get out of that conversation. And I think, wow, you know, it is true. You are very poor people. And then I'd say, so, okay, Charlie over here just talked about being poor, but let's move on. And who else has something? And I'd point to someone and he'd say, Jerry, what do you think? And he'd say, well, it's true we're poor, but we've always been poor. And that's not news. I think the biggest problem we got is our schools. Our schools stink. I mean, if you impacted our schools, then we wouldn't be poor because we would be better educated and we'd actually get jobs. But instead, we just kind of mire around here, and everyone who is able to be educated leaves. So no one stays in this village. It sounds like a real small town in America, doesn't it? So we talk about that for 30 minutes, and I'd say, well, that's a great point. And write that on the board. Our schools are terrible. This is a depressing conversation so far, right? And then I'd say, one more. How about right back there? And somebody raised a hand. He said, I'm Kent. Kent, tell me what you think. And he'd say, well, it's true we're broke, and it's true our schools stink. But I tell you what, my biggest problem is I feel terrible right now. I have malaria. And I've had three kids die. And my brother has AIDS. And there's no hospital near here. And I know this is nice having this conversation, but my head hurts so bad. Could you take me back home with you? And so while I was enjoying my, this guy's saying, I feel terrible. Can I go to the hospital? And there's no clinic within 20 miles. And when I and I'd say, tell me more about that. And they'd say, well, you know, when my last kid was born, we put him, my wife on a bike. She was 9 months pregnant, and we rode for 12 miles to get there. And the doctor wasn't there, and there was no electricity, and there were no drugs, and the baby died. So we talked through that. And I said, this didn't happen one time. This happened over and over and over. And so then I'd say, okay, we heard from these men. I'd get out my my one voice button, and I would say, let's hear from a woman. What do you think? And so the women in Uganda, they kneel when they greet you, so they do this. And my dad was, it came from Michigan, he was very troubled by this. He's an older guy, you know, and he would tell people, don't you kneel for anyone, you know, he'd try to get them up. And so these women would kneel and say, it's true we're broke, it's true our schools stink, it's true healthcare situation is lousy. But you know what, my from my perspective, drill us a well. I mean, and I'd say, tell me, this is a woman who has second or third grade education and is articulating development theory better than the PhDs at Tufts University. And she says, here's the deal for me. If you get me water, I can water my plants and I'll have a small garden, but it'll grow. If you get me water, my kids won't have to come home, go 4 miles to get water, and ruin and spend 4 hours of their life every night rather than sitting home studying. And by the time they get home with water, none of them can read because we can't afford kerosene and it's already dark. And so they go to school the next day not having studied. And not only that, the number one indicator for health in Africa is what? It's fresh water. So Paul Farmer would tell you, don't build a hospital, drill a well. So I can imagine having this conversation. It's depressing. But I would say, this is kind of overwhelming to be here. And when I first got there, it was really overwhelming. But then I would say, you know what? Here's the encouraging thing, or discouraging. I can't decide which. This place reminds me so much of my hometown of Flint, Michigan. I would say, let me tell you about Flint, Michigan. When I grew up, my dad, who was from Arkansas, a sharecropper who came up to work for General Motors, we'd get in our Chevy pickup, and we would drive right out onto the lake and punch a hole in the lake and fish. And these Ugandans would be like, what? I say, yeah, that's what we did. And my hometown has collapsing health care. My hometown has terrible schools. My hometown has an economic situation that is the worst in the United States, just by statistics. And if you went and talked to them, they would say, oh, it's, you know, if I got off the plane and just walked in downtown Flint and said, what's wrong with Flint? They would articulate the exact same list. They'd even say, you know what, I don't even drink the water here anymore. You know, I buy bottled water. But what shocks me even more than that is if we went to Tokyo and asked people, what do you tell me about Tokyo these days? If you went to London and you said, tell me about London these days. If you went to Rome and said, tell me about Rome these days. If you went to Los Angeles, the richest place in the world. And we walked to downtown Los Angeles that has a bigger gross domestic product, by the way, than all of sub-Saharan Africa combined, save South Africa. Los Angeles County, one county, bigger gross domestic product than sub-Saharan Africa. So we're talking literally the richest county in the world. And by the way, we stand in the richest place in that county or in that area. And if you went in L.A. and you said, tell me what's wrong with L.A. They'd say, man, our schools are terrible. We have metal detectors. Healthcare for the average Mexican immigrant here, it's just non-existent. They just go to the emergency room and they don't get good care. And work at Taco Bell? Try to buy a house working at Taco Bell here. There's no American dream in L.A., it's not true. And they'd say, you know, all the earthquakes, I don't drink the water. It's funny because, and I would say, here's the deal. First off, I hope it makes you mad that in my culture, we are so self-absorbed that we would really believe that our problems even begin to touch yours. But we do. And that's people. And guess what? If I go back home and I tell them about this small village in Uganda, guess what they say? Are we still helping those people over there, starving people? What's the problem? Don't they work? Right? I get that all the time. I have people who come and we go all over the place talking about manna, and it's always the question. Mark, I got a question for you. Appreciate what you're doing there. Not to be, but I'm usually in Georgia, so this is the accent. Appreciate what you're doing there and manna. Starving kids is a really good thing, but don't we have starving people right here in America? And I say, no, we don't. We don't have starving people. Call the CDC and ask them how many people starved to death last year. We do have hungry kids. It's a big deal. I mean, those of you who work in school feeding programs, if your kid goes to school hungry, he's not going to learn anything. He walks in your classroom. So hunger is a big issue. They're not dying from it, but their lives are being destroyed by it because they're not going to go to college. They're not going to do just from the simple issue of hunger. So it's a big deal, but it's not quite at that level. So my question was to my Ugandan friends, does this make you mad that these people are so self-centered that they would say, I don't really care about Africa because I'm so absorbed in my own. I would say, in my hometown, here's how I decided if I was rich or not. What kind of jeans I wore. You see, in my country, if you, this is in the 80s especially, if you had a certain stitch on your jean, then that meant you were cool. Or how many cars you had, or what sort of television you had, not if you had a television. I didn't tell them, but I grew up in a house that had a television. This is before the remote. I get pretty put out with my kids who complain about the remote not working or you can't find it. We had a broken television that had a pair of vice grips clamped to the channel changer, and there were only three channels, you know. We had it tough, I tell you. And yet, you tell a Ugandan that and say, you know, I knew I was poor because we had such a bad vacuum cleaner. What? Are you kidding me? Or because of that, I only had four pairs of jeans instead of 17, or because I drove the wrong car. And they're like, what are you talking about? Now, that either means that we're very selfish, self-centered people, which is sadly probably true of much of our culture, but it's also human nature, and I don't think that these systems are good anywhere, right? They're broken everywhere. Is healthcare good here? It's not what it should be. Are our schools as good as they should be? No, they're not as good as they should be. And so these are problems that are common to the human race. And the cool thing about the Millennium Development Goals is it says, let's not shoot with a shotgun anymore. Let's shoot with a rifle at these eight things. And I want to show you real quickly, and someone needs to wave at me when I run out of time, which has got to be soon. This is the progress chart from 2012, so there's only 2 years left. What they said was we're going to measure these, and just to give you an idea, green means we're doing great, yellow means we're doing okay, red means we're headed the wrong direction. Now, there's not a lot of red there, is there? That's pretty cool, isn't it? Look at Africa over the last 15 years. We have fewer hungry people in Africa because of the Millennium Development Goals specifically, and every country would say so. And what it is it's a strategic effort to say when Norway gives aid, when the United States gives aid, when all of these groups give aid, we are going to hold them accountable. We're going to say, do you have good governance? If you don't have good governance, no more money for you. And in all of these areas that I eradicate extreme poverty and hunger, that's something that David Todd and I work on with malnutrition. Achieving universal primary education, good news across the board there. Promote gender equality and empowerment of women. Reduce child mortality, look at that, green all the way across. Improving maternal health, big deal. About 90% of the women in some countries in Africa are anemic. And how many of you ladies, you've been anemic, you know how tired you feel. And imagine having a kid on your back and a hoe and a 50-pound weight on your head, and your iron level is so low. And so through projects that have gotten sweet potatoes, orange sweet potatoes into people's hands, we've changed that. Malaria, HIV, and AIDS headed the right direction, mostly. Environmental sustainability, we're heading the right direction in most places. And global partnerships for development. Just the idea that we're actually working together and we're organized. Now, the reason I wanted to kind of bring this up in this class is to challenge those of us who go back to our own little world and to say, now how does that apply to my life? And I think it has some really cool and interesting implications. First off, just the idea that we can dream big. If these countries who don't have the Spirit of God working through them can dream this big, or I wouldn't say they don't have the Spirit of God working through them because the Spirit of God works wherever it pleases, right? And so there's all kinds of good work going on all around the world that's happening in God's name because of God, and He has chosen, and this should be the shame of the church, He has chosen to use these guys. And we might say, well, it's because they have money. It's not about money. It's about getting organized, and it's about being focused, and it's about saying specifically, I want to deal with this issue. And there are many organizations that say, that's only our issue. With ours, we work only on malnutrition, but there are many partnerships that have come in, and generally, good things are happening. You know, in the midst of bad news stories all around, we are making a difference globally. And one of the things that shocks me is when I go to these meetings, and I sit with secular groups, how absent the church is. Now, first off, it would be grossly unpopular. I mean, I learned when I got to Washington that I need to rebrand myself instead of call myself a missionary, which was grossly unpopular. I decided to be like Paul and to be all things to all people and call myself a development worker. So I went to grad school for development stuff and got a job in doing that. But I find development to be wanting and sort of sad and sort of empty. But I find the work of the church and the mission of the church to be super exciting and empowering and the only thing that's going to change the world. When Jesus died, there were 11 guys. Those 11, he comes back, and remember Peter jumps in and swims up to the shore, and he sits down eating fish, and he says, Peter, feed my sheep. From there, fast forward 2,000 years, there are more Christians in the world than there are Chinese. That's pretty good from 11. We're part of a fairly successful crowd. There are more Christians in the world than there are Indians right now. There are more Christians in the world today than there are Indians and Chinese combined. It's a pretty wildly successful project, right? Not that every one of those person has the right doctrine or theology or is committed totally to Christ, but when they say their name, they say, my name is Matthew, or my name is David. Their identity says, I'm a follower of Christ. That's amazing. You are part of the most successful operation that has ever hit the earth. And you ever watch football players who complain? Does it make you mad when NBA players complain? Do you want to say, wait a minute, buddy, you get paid more than I will make in my life in a year to dribble a ball and you're complaining? And yet I think of the church and I think we should say to ourselves, wait a minute, you're part of the greatest organization in the history of the earth and you feel helpless and you don't feel empowered? The Holy Spirit, I think, is eager to partner with people who would see this and say, wow, what an opportunity. Not that we need to go back to our churches and say we are now working on Millennium Development Goal number 4, eradicating this or that. But instead to say, what would this look like in my town? What would this kind of approach for my church? And what one area there? Because I would suggest, and I'd argue that these goals are probably not all that different in Amarillo, just like in your hometown of Searcy, just like it was in my hometown. Kent Massey is sitting in the back there. He gave me a book recently, and it is called Get Off Your Donkey. This is an awesome little book. If you get a chance, I wrote all through it, so I can't give it back to Kent, but I read it on various plane trips. And so write down, get off your donkey. And so I want to show you the King James of the Good Samaritan as we sort of close out here. What time is it, by the way? Someone needs to throw something at me when it's 2 o'clock. And I quit when? All right, good. I got a lot of time. And behold, a certain lawyer stood up and tempted him, saying, Master, what shall I do to inherit eternal life? And he said unto him, what is written in the law? How readest thou? And he answered and said, thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart and thy soul, with all thy strength, with all thy mind, and thy neighbor as thyself. And he said unto him, thou hast answered right. This do, and thou shalt live. But he, willing to justify himself, said unto Jesus, and who is my neighbor? And Jesus answering said, a certain man went down from Jerusalem to Jericho, and he fell among thieves, which stripped him of his raiment and wounded him and departed, leaving him half dead. And by chance there came down a certain priest that way, and when he saw him, he passed by on the other side. And likewise a Levite, when he was at the place, came and looked at him and passed by on the other side where he was. And when he saw him, he had... I think I skipped out. And then there came the Samaritan. I think he got left out of here. And when he saw him, he had compassion on him and went to him and bound up his wounds, pouring in oil and wine, and sent him on his own ass and brought him to an inn and took care of him. And the morrow he departed, and he took out 2 pence, and he gave them to the host, and he said unto him, take care of him, and whatsoever thou spendest when I come again, I will repay thee. Now which now of these three thinkest thou was neighbor unto him that fell among the thieves? And he said, he that showed mercy on him. And then Jesus said, go and do likewise. Now, it strikes me that there's a couple things from this story that I think fit with this kind of Millennium Development Goal attitude. And the one is that if you're going to help the world, the first thing you got to do is get off of your ass, right? That's the King James Version anyway. Get off your donkey, this guy said. And the religious people in the story, I had read the story so many times, but it was the two religious guys who walked by. They passed by on the other side. And I have to imagine now, how many people have read When Helping Hurts? Have you seen this book? I just imagine that that these guys were reading, you know, in the modern version, and two passed by who were reading When Helping Hurts. And they stopped and said, "Wow, you know, we were just reading When Helping Hurts and realized that if we helped you, it might hurt you. In fact, we're working on a more systematic view of trying to get more lighting on this road because it's an unsafe road. And we think that if we helped you, we might enable you and others to have irresponsible behavior like you've had. And it probably wouldn't be best for you if we helped you." I don't know if that's part of the mentality that went through, but I often hear this When Helping Hurts mentality, which is very good stuff to say, you know, we need to be smart about the way we help. But it's just an excuse to just pass by on the other side of the road. So the first thing you got to do is get off your donkey. The next thing you got to do is have a solution. You've got to steer yourself into the ditch and your whole organization into the ditch to find this guy who's in the ditch, right? If you look at that, I've never been there, but I've read that road coming down from Jerusalem to Jericho. Those of you who have been there, I heard it's an amazing road. And it's narrow and twisty, and it falls down about 2,000 feet. It goes straight down to sea level from way up high. And as he came down that road, it's a lousy road. And if you look at the context of Luke, Jesus is telling the story. And just before that, remember he sends out the disciples? Just before that, remember where they were? They were in a Samaritan village. And that's where he said, if people reject you, you just shake your feet off. And the disciples said, "What about the Samaritan village? Should we call down fire on these guys?" And so they'd just been rejected by the Samaritans, at least the way it's told in Luke. And this is the only place it's told, so Luke is the only story that we have from the Good Samaritan. And it's the very guys who rejected in the previous chapter. And then in chapter 10, you get the story of this guy who's looking to figure out who his neighbor is. And Jesus says, "Get off of your donkey," number one. Number two, get down in the ditch. And number three, have a solution. He showed up with oil and wine, right? Oil and wine for the day is the stuff you would put on there. And the number four thing he did was to be unsafe. You know, Martin Luther King has a famous, have you ever heard Martin Luther King's Good Samaritan? It's one of the best sermons I've ever heard. And he says, here's the main question that most people ask. If I stop and help this guy, what's going to happen to me? And Martin Luther King said, but the Good Samaritan said, if I don't stop and help this guy, what's going to happen to this guy? I've got to stop. And I've got to be unsafe in that regard. And I've got to show up with some sort of solution with the oil and wine. And the final thing, when you show up with those solutions, what did he do? Where did he take him? He took him to an inn, and he developed partnerships. I think sometimes we're just paralyzed by the fact that we have to do everything alone. His partner was the innkeeper. And he reached in his pocket, and he was generous and said, you know, here's a little bit of money that I want to partner with you to solve this guy's problem. He didn't start an NGO. He didn't start a movement. He didn't worry about it being sustainable, as far as I can tell from reading the story. He just said, this is my interaction with someone who is hurting, who has been beat up by thieves, who has been attacked by the big bad wolf. And it's an amazing story. When I think about mission, I don't know how many of your churches have gone through the mission, vision, values type thing. You've gone through that. You have a mission. It can go on forever. And then at the end, no one can remember what it was. Was that our vision or was that our mission? And I can't remember that stuff. So I want to suggest this, and this is something that Reggie says that I think is really great in this book, that he says, your church doesn't have a mission. The mission has a church. The mission existed before the church ever existed. And our theme here being Revelation, when we get to the end, the mission is going to continue beyond the church, right? So we have the story, the church doesn't exist at the beginning, and God's mission does, and this mission goes on. And in chapter 18 of Revelation, in keeping with our theme, when you read Revelation, I was just sitting with Greg Stevenson, who's a good friend of mine, who wrote the book on this stuff, and we were talking about how a big part of chapter 18 in Revelation is about the indictment of Babylon for economic disparity. And that's the big beef, that's the criticism, that you live and you don't, that's the big crime, sort of, in chapter 18, and the indictment that John brings down as the revelator. And we start to think that, you know, our favorite verse is that God so loved the church that he gave his only begotten son. He didn't say that, did he? That God so loved the world that he gave his only only begotten Son. I want to close with, as you attack that mission, and here's what I would suggest the mission of God is. I think there's also the life lessons from, you know, that there are thieves out robbing. People pass by, two-thirds of the people actually pass by, and you have an opportunity to not be one of those people. It takes more than empathy. It takes solutions and partnerships with other people. And that Jesus is this radical leader of ours because he expands the definition of neighbor for the guy, right? That's a big problem I think we struggle with in our country. Who is our neighbor? We have a very Monroe Doctrine view of the world that we retreat back to, which is, this is kind of us against them. But that the mission of God is this, that God's mission is the redemptive restoration of everything. True? That's the mission we're a part of, the redemptive restoration, that sin has tarnished and broken so much in this world that God says, you go find people and you give them life and hope in every way you touch them. Now, that is not, one of the titles of this class was Why the Millennium Development Goals Are Old School Gospel Pursuits. Because if we're development people, we show up with this empty rhetoric of you need to be cleaner. But if we are people of God, we show up and we show up with this narrative of God saying, I want to fix the world that's broken. And the only way to do it is this relationship with Jesus Christ. There are three metaphors that I think your church can think through as you go about this. So one is you've got to get off your donkey, you've got to do something. Don't just talk about it, just go out and do something if there's a takeaway from this class. But then you think, boy, that's not very helpful. I don't know what we're going to do. But the other thing you can do is you can talk, because your words, when you speak words, your words eventually become your actions, especially if you speak them boldly enough, right? If you say something to someone and say, I'm going to do this, then if they're your friend, they'll call you on it and say, well, you said you were going to do this. So you can speak these words. And when we speak these words and when we go out and kind of communicate our mission to other people, this mission of being redemptive and fixing a broken world that we encountered in the villages of Uganda, that my town, Flint, Michigan, encounters in every way, that your town definitely encounters, and yet we have this super church inward focus that we think that God so loved the church, God so loved the church. No, God so loved the world. So here are the narratives I think you can use as you go out. There are three narratives to sell anybody anything, or metaphors. The first one is this, the metaphor of war. And think about the metaphor of war. That says, I drive a Chevy, you drive a Ford. Chevy is way better than Ford. We're at war with Ford. We hate Ford. I grew up with the metaphor of war with General Motors versus Toyota because I was in a General Motors town, right? We hate it. We didn't just dislike them. We hated Toyota. And they won. That's the terrible thing. They put us out of business. But that metaphor of war is very much a church metaphor as well. So it's a marketing metaphor. If I want to get you to buy something, then I've got to say, hey, don't buy Pepsi, buy Coke, or don't buy Kraft, buy General Mills, or whatever it is, and I've got to put myself up against this other thing. Don't buy Nike, buy Reebok, and there is this competition and this metaphor of war. And it's very powerful, and it's been around forever, right? And if you watch old television commercials, they're very much in that genre. But then we got more nuanced as the years came along, and we left the metaphor of war largely, and we moved on to a metaphor of science. And the metaphor of science says this. It's not that I hate them. It's just studies show that Pepsi has less sugar or that my Prius is better for the environment or whatever it is. And so basically the metaphor of science says I'm going to twist statistics in my favor, basically, to tell the narrative that I need to tell of this metaphor of science. And so I believe it's a little bit higher than the metaphor of war. I'm not just at battle with things, but I am actually doing this because it's better, it's superior. And think about our churches, how when we articulate who we are to people, there's a metaphor of war. I mean, I'm not the Baptists. We're not those guys, you know, so there's this war with others. There's also the metaphor of science, which says, no, I mean, it's very, you read scripture and you kind of argue with people, or even literal science, you know, against evolution or whatever. But the last one is this, and it is, to me, the most powerful, and it's the one that I think fits with this generation the most. It is the metaphor of redemption. Think of every movie you've ever seen. It's about redemption at the end. And if they don't redeem something at the end, you're kind of half mad, right? You know what movies that don't redeem? Schindler's List. And many others, they take you through the story of redemption. And that metaphor of, and in fact, you could just leave off redemption and just say it's a story that you want to be a part of. Think about products right now. If you want to relate to younger people, don't talk metaphor of war. Don't talk metaphor of science. Talk metaphor of story. Talk about redemption. Talk about why do people have Apple products? Why do people wear Tom's shoes? Why do people go to Starbucks? Remember, Starbucks was going down like this, and the old guy, Howard, what's his name, Schultz, came back, and he pulled it back up out of the nosedive because he began to tell the story and the narrative again. And I would argue that that's the huge advantage we have. The development world, who's worried about the Millennium Development Goals and progress on these things, they have to stay with science because that's what they believe in. And they have to stay with war, like we're at war with malaria, right? And that we have this amazing story that God is wanting to redeem all the broken stuff in the world. And for me and for us and our company, then it's very, you know, it's out there, it's global. But I think that that kind of mentality of this, of looking at these type of very base, simple things in our communities are the way for the church to be relevant and for the way to the church to be inviting, for the way to the church to have a story that people embrace. It's not, hey, what do you think about me? But it's us talking to them and saying, let's talk about you. Let's pray together, and then I'll let you out of here. But I appreciate you coming, and thanks so much for being some of the few. God, we want to be a part of your story, and we want to fix a broken world. We don't know how to. We're broken ourselves. But we realize we're part of, in the church, your tool for accomplishing a big part of your mission, which is redemption of all people. And so we're excited about that. Help us, forgive us when we complain about it, when we don't have optimism. We don't believe that the Holy Spirit is more powerful than us. And give us creative thinking and creative minds. If the G8 can be this creative and this organized, surely we, empowered by your Spirit, can be twice as creative and as organized and as passionate about measuring and accomplishing things within our own communities. We lift that up to you in the name of your Son, Jesus. Amen. Thank you much. Any questions, you can come on up or whatever.